From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The Federal Reserve wants new rules to keep credit card companies in check, but will banks fight tooth and nail to keep things as they are? And the House passes a bill that could help nearly 2 million troubled homeowners refinance. So why is the president saying he's going to veto it? Economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux is here to give us her perspective. She is also the president of Bennett College. Hi, Dr. Malveaux.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great. So let's talk about credit cards. I mean, I've got stories. I'm going to tell you one, but not right now. So tell us first, what's the Federal Reserve proposing?
Well, the Fed is trying to make sure that credit card companies give people more notice, that they can't raise interest rates just arbitrarily, that they change the time that's late. Really, that credit card companies treat people more fairly. The fact is that the industry has been arbitrary and capricious. You may pay your bill on time, Farai, but let's say that you've used a little more credit, so you've gone into another $4,000 or $5,000 worth of debt. The company may look at it and say, "Oh, Farai's not quite who she thought we thought she was. Let's raise her interest rate by a couple percentage points." Never calling you, never giving you the option to explain or anything else. You have good credit, you cut a deal. They change the deal, there's nothing you can do about it. And so Ben Bernanke, I think, is doing great job, a really great job in pushing the credit card industry back. He's a lot more, I think, aggressive toward the industry than the former Fed chair, Alan Greenspan, was. You know that the credit card companies clearly have lobbied. They have purchased Congress people outright, so that the bankruptcy bill that finally passed a few years ago put your credit cards as one of the things that you could not discharge with bankruptcy, gave credit card companies a higher priority than child support. So these companies are playing hardball, and they believe that they have the legislative muscle to do so, but this is really good. This is a really good proposal.
So when you talk about the laws that have been governing credit cards, have they gotten looser over time for those credit card companies, or have they always been pretty much not so much regulation?
The credit card companies have a better deal than they had 10 years ago. The consumer protection has gone out the window with the Bush administration. So where we had, and not just the Bush administration, that's almost not fair, but in the past 30 years, you've seen the amount of consumer protection just decline significantly. A lot of that has to do with the fact that there has been less regulation. There has been a loosening of regulation. Credit card companies have been allowed to do whatever they like.
Now, let me give you, Dr. Malveaux, an example from my own life. I've been working hard to get my financial house in order so that I can buy a physical house. So I cut off one credit card, and I had been doing electronic bill pay. And so the credit card is closed, but first of all, I get an additional bill, which is for interest. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll go. They had already sent me a refund, but then I have to pay them more interest, so I send them the interest. Then they keep deducting the automatic payments. And I'm like, what the heck is going on here? And they were like, well, just because you've ended the credit card doesn't mean that you end the automatic payments. You have to end those separately. I was like, what is going on here? I mean, is that a typical kind
of
situation?
That's very typical. Another typical thing that happens is that, let's say you've got something, well, the automatic bill pay is a great example. You've got something connected to the credit card. You've closed the credit card. They'll keep billing you. You might have gotten one of these insurances or, you know, let's say that a lot of people get this credit report watch thing and you're being charged $9.95 a month. Close a credit card, you think that's the end of it. No, it's not the end of it. You have to, literally, you have to be so diligent and so vigilant. And some of these things would seem to be commonsensical, but this is not about common sense for them. It's about maximizing profit. I have a woman who, I just came from vacation, a woman was telling about her mom died, and they're still billing her for some kind of life insurance. Her mom died.
Now, when we talk about all this, everyone has a responsibility to watch their own finances. And what we're really talking about is what's the responsibility on the other side in terms of companies that deal with consumers. So how much, regardless of what the laws are right now, what kind of steps can people take in terms of really making sure that they are dealing with credit card companies in a way that keeps their record clean?
People should look at their statements, and one of the biggest mistakes people make is they just pay the, you know, they pay their bill. They don't look carefully at their statement. Make sure that everything on that statement is something you want to have there. If there's some kind of recurrent charge, make sure you really want that, whatever the service is. And if you don't want it, cut it off. And if they don't respond from a phone call, put it in writing. It's always best to put it in writing, to document it. If you do make a phone call, make a note of the date that you called so that if you have any trouble later, you can deal with it. I think that, you know, the other thing is when your rate goes up, you didn't agree to a rate increase, but the rate goes up, call them. I mean, you do have a right to call, and sometimes people will actually negotiate with you. I mean, they want your business. So you can call them and say, look, I'm not paying 17.9%. I got into this card at 10%, 10.9%, and I want to go back. You might end up somewhere in the middle, but don't ever think that they won't talk to you. And don't be afraid. I mean, if you're one of these people who moves balances around, if there is a card that the people just will not cooperate with you, close the card. Now, it does have ramifications for your credit score. When you're closing cards, especially cards that you've had a long time, those are the ones you want to keep because it shows longevity, et cetera. So you do have to be careful with that. And I will send you a couple of things, Farai, that you can put on the website regarding the credit score because it's a lot of manipulation and you really don't ever know exactly what to do. But don't be afraid to stand up to these folks and don't be afraid to complain to the Federal Trade Commission about the ways that the credit card companies are dealing with you.
Well, we'll be sure to get those up on NPR News and Notes and nprnewsandviews.org. So let's talk housing. The U.S. House of Representatives just approved a bill that some folks are calling the Rescue Bill. What does that really mean?
Basically, the housing bailout bill would allow consumers to renegotiate the terms of their mortgages to get more affordable mortgage rates. The mortgage interest rate for a 30-year mortgage is now hovering at about 6%, a little below 6%. You've got people locked into very high mortgage rates. You've got people who are defaulting because they can't pay. And basically, it will allow a renegotiation, and it will have the federal government guarantee these mortgages, which means that, yes, the taxpayer at some level will pay if people default, but basically what we'll do is stave off this horrible housing crisis that we're experiencing. We look at cities like Detroit, we look at other cities where we see the default rate so high that we're really worried about the stability. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, of course, introduced some of this legislation because of the challenges that were being faced in her own district. And so it's good legislation. The president and some of the Republicans are against it. They've never been against providing money for anyone else. Bear Stearns got a break. Why not people?
Some folks, though, are arguing that this bill could actually reward speculators who either are landlords who own places in neighborhoods in trouble or who want to buy up distressed properties. What do you think about that?
You know, that is a concern, the notion of speculators. And my suggestion in terms of the Senate amending the legislation is perhaps that we would limit the number of each individual to one refinancing. So that if a speculator or someone else has several properties, they can only do the refinancing on one. I also don't think, I mean, there was a provision in the legislation that would provide dollars for people who are buying in these distressed areas. And it's not clear to me that that ought to happen. I think what we're attempting to do, it seems to me, is to shore up those folks, those individual families that are having a hard time, partly because of the predatory policies of the banking industry. So I think that there's some ways that the Senate can tweak this. Of course, it's always difficult, and I'm sure a speculator or two will slide in. But I think it's more important to help those struggling working-class and middle-class families who are having a hard time because of layoffs, because of the state of the economy, and because of the predatory practices of some lenders.
So I'm at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. this week. I was at home in Baltimore for Mother's Day yesterday, saw a lot of for sale signs in the neighborhood I live in Los Angeles. I see a lot of for sale signs. Tell me more about what you mean about these housing issues throwing neighborhoods into jeopardy of being destabilized.
Well, when you see all the for sale signs, if those properties are vacant, no one's going to take care of them. You take neighborhoods that were solid, you know, working class or middle class neighborhoods where you had people who had property, who were keeping up their property, adding to everyone's property value. Now flip it. People start selling their homes. They have to sell them. They're foreclosed. They're empty. The lawn gets overrun. If they're empty, I mean, squatters or anyone else can go into them, heaven forbid drug dealers, whomever, and the stable families who are there see their property values begin to decline. The neighborhood becomes less desirable for them. They perhaps start looking not because they want to leave their home, but because the neighborhood just isn't that great anymore. So literally a strong housing market breeds strong neighborhoods, strong families, strong communities. So this downward spiral affects many people who are frankly quite innocent.
When you think about what people can do on a local community level, what is it? If you go to your neighborhood association, what can you really accomplish in the face of this national crisis?
It's not clear that community organizing is the answer to this, except to the extent that people really do reach out to their members of Congress and talk about the kind of legislation that they want, make sure that they understand, because a lot of people are playing the blame game and saying, well, why should we bail out these irresponsible people? What about the responsible people? Well, the responsible people need to let it be known that they don't think their neighbors are necessarily irresponsible. What they think has been going on is that banks and others have been predatory. But people do need to reach out to members of Congress. We're right at that crunch time for Rye before Memorial Day. They're going to try to get most of the legislation done before Memorial Day because, of course, they have want to get out, and we've got a hot political season. Not much is going to get done this summer as people, you know, get ready for the two conventions. And so this really is the time, these next 2 weeks, where people should be picking up the telephone, calling their congressperson, and saying, you know, we support this legislation.
All right. Well, Dr. Malvo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was author and economist Julianne Malvo. She is also the president of Bennett College. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. R. Kelly heads to court on pornography charges years after the alleged crime. Senator Hillary Clinton fights on for the Democratic nomination, but her campaign is millions of dollars in debt, and more activists protest a beating by police in Philadelphia. Our bloggers are ready to dig into those stories of the day. With us, we've got Jay Anderson. He blogs at averagebro.com, Meji Alibi, who blogs at anythingblack.net, and Shay Riley, who writes at bookerrising.blogspot.com. Hey, folks.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
So let's start with the race to the White House. According to CNN, Clinton says she's within striking distance of getting the popular vote. Jay, do you think the numbers are with her?
The numbers are not with her. I mean, let's just be honest. The thing was over on Super Tuesday. Now you're just kind of prolonging the inevitable. And I really wish, I don't know. I think this shows the weakness of the party leadership. Honestly, you have to, the thing's been over for months. Why don't they just go ahead and have Howard Dean step in and intercede and just have the remaining superdelegates come over? It's just prolonging the inevitable. It's damaging the candidate, the presumptive candidate, Barack Obama, the longer he stays in the race or the longer that this thing, you know, is prolonged. It's just unnecessary.
Meji, let me ask you about money, because Senator Clinton's campaign, according to The Washington Post today, is $20 million in debt. That means not only has she put in $11 million of her own money that she might not get back, but also there are advisors who haven't been paid. And there's also talk of whether or not Senator Obama should actually, you know, kick her the cash and say, hey, you know, here, you know, peace and blessings, be gone. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know. I think she's just wasting her time, you know, like putting her own money in there. I think she should just step out of the race, because if she keeps on, like, once you have to put your own money and you're not getting any donations, you're really just wasting your time, in my opinion. Like,
Shay,
Obama gets donations.
Oh, please go ahead.
Obama has been getting donations, and he's been getting a lot of money in for his campaign, and he doesn't feel like he has to put his own money in there. So I think she's just pulling their own strings, my opinion.
Shay, it's funny, you know, here on the show we get letters from Clinton supporters saying that we're too pro-Obama and from Obama supporters saying that we're too pro-Clinton. I know we'll get letters about this, but what I want to do to follow up on that money question is that, you know, I talked to someone who was an Obama supporter, and she said, under no circumstances should my campaign donations go to Hillary Clinton. What do you think about that argument, even if it made it easier for Senator Obama to get the nomination if he paid those debts? And this is all speculation, but it's speculation by a lot of political insiders. Do you think that Obama supporters would be unhappy if their money went to pay off Senator Clinton's debts?
I don't think so, because I think they would understand that in terms of their, I would assume, their long-term goal, which is to get Obama, and if not Obama, a Democrat into the White House, they would understand the, you know, that strategic maneuver, if you will. So I think that people would be maybe a little upset in the beginning, but would understand that that's what Obama had to do, if he has to do that, in order to get Hillary Clinton out of the race.
Jay, the West Virginia primary is on Tuesday, and Senator Clinton's ahead in the polls. So do you think that this counteracts your argument that the race is over for her?
The race is over. I mean, how many? There are 40-some delegates, I believe, up for play tomorrow in West Virginia. It's just, again, it's prolonging the inevitable. And I think overall, I know you're probably going to mention the whole soundbite that Senator Clinton came out last week about, you know, the hardworking Americans. And I don't know. I mean, obviously, she'll probably have a very healthy victory tomorrow. But it kind of goes back to, you know, her comments about having the support of hardworking white Americans, as if those are the only people whose votes matter. I don't know. I thought that inference was just ridiculous. I'm not saying it's overtly racist, but there are just some things that are better left unsaid. There may be some truth to it, but you can't just say that type of stuff.
And, you know, please go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to piggyback off of that. You know, I definitely agree that Clinton, you know, should be rightfully criticized and has been for that hardworking white Americans comment, which implied that, you know, black voters or affluent white voters, educated whites, aren't hard workers. So I certainly understand the offense taken with that. But I think she was correct in that her base of support is potentially broader than that of Obama's. And Obama has not been fully vetted yet. And I think that's part of the reason why there's some superdelegates who are kind of on hold to see how it plays out, even though it looks like Obama will get the nomination because of the pledged delegates and such. But because Clinton has her base of working class whites, Hispanics, and white women, that is potentially a broader base than the kind of McGovern-esque base that Obama has going into the general election. Because black voters, no matter what, are going to support the Democratic nominee 90-10 anyway. And that's what Clinton is counting on.
I just
the white
really
working
dislike
class voters
I'm
and
sorry.
Hispanics are more swing voters.
I just dislike the categorization of white voters as working class. They're upper class. They're blue collar. They're middle American. They're NASCAR dads, they're soccer moms. If you're black, you're just black. I mean, it's just, again, it's an insult to the intelligence of the typical voter to assume that, again, a person is genetically predisposed to vote for a certain candidate. I just think, again, that's hilarious. And to consider the fact that this may be a person that could possibly be the president in the fall, I just don't like that type of politics, and I think it's time for us to move beyond that.
Meji, let me get Meji in here. Democrats have struggled with attracting white voters, you know, frankly, for the last four decades. And President Bush beat John Kerry by 17 points with white voters, Al Gore by 12 points among white voters. Even President Clinton didn't get the votes, the majority of white male votes. So do you think that there is just a situation where the Democrats can't, whether it's a winning president like Clinton or a losing candidate like Kerry, that the Democrats can't count on the white vote carrying them to victory?
Well, I mean, in my opinion, I think most of the people in this country are, the white people are Republicans, and they won't win off the white vote itself. So Democrats need black vote, they need the white vote, they need a lot of people's votes. And what I was going to say about they're saying about Hillary only being interested in the white vote in those states, I just think that, you know, America's more than white, and it's a mesh of different cultures, and she should focus her campaign on all the races instead of just talk about how hardworking people are white. And
I actually want to reintroduce who's talking and what we're doing. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea, and we were just hearing from Meji Alibi, who blogs at anythingblack.net. This is part of today's Bloggers Roundtable. We've also got Jay Anderson, who blogs at averagebro.com, and Shay Riley, who writes for bookerrising.blogspot.com. And I want to make sure we have two more topics. I want to make sure that we have time to get to them. So, Meji, I'm going to ask you about something completely different. Jury selection finally started started on the R. Kelly child pornography case. Attorneys for the prosecution and defense are expected to continue questioning 150 potential jurors. That started on Friday, and Kelly entered the court on Friday to cheers and jeers. It's been 6 years since the R&B star was charged with having sex with an underage girl and videotaping it. That tape was downloaded to the internet, watched by people all over the country. Now, Meji, how old are you again?
I'm 19.
You're 19 years old, so you are in a demographic that where R. Kelly has been around as a recording star for pretty much your whole life. What are people your age saying about the R. Kelly case?
Well, to tell the truth, people think the whole case is played out. It's kind of old, you know, it's been 6 years. I mean, it took him way too long to get to trial. He's been waiting to go to courthouse for, you know, the last 5 years, and I just think most people think he didn't do it, but, I mean, it's clear that, you know, he did do it, and I don't know, I think he probably won't get convicted, but that's just how it is.
Jay, do you think it's that most people think he didn't do it, or most people are willing to forgive a celebrity anything?
Come on, I mean, let's keep it real here again. Yes, he did it. I mean, there's a tape out there. I haven't seen it.
As a reporter, I have to say it's alleged, but you say that
I haven't seen it, but I've heard of enough people who said they've seen it. And hey, if it walks like a duck, it is probably a duck. Let's just be honest about why R. Kelly is still walking free 6 years later. He's a celebrity who happens to make a lot of other people a lot of money. If this was some, you know, one-hit wonder, like, I don't know, Al B. Shore or something, he'd be under the jail by now. But
I think Al had at least two hits.
Al had two hits. Okay, Off on Your Own Girl and Night and Day. Okay,
yep.
Two hits. But still, the fact is, R. Kelly makes so many other people money. I think, again, that's what's given him the six-year pass here and has allowed him to just keep making records. But, you know, it's to pay the Pied Piper R&B now. He's going to do his time.
Shay, the alleged victim is now 23 years old, and she says that she wasn't the girl in the tape. So what do you make of that?
Well, I haven't seen the tape, so I can't determine whether or not that is true. But, you know, I've never been an R. Kelly fan anyway, but I suspect that she is saying that because of potential negative publicity that would come her way, or she has, you know, been told to keep quiet, so to speak. But, you know, the trial is definitely in the news here in Chicago. It's everywhere because R. Kelly's from Chicago. And to me, how I look at the case, it just seems like it's another example of how alleged perpetrators of crime, especially if they're celebrities, are given preference over alleged black crime victims, especially if they're female. So that kind of raises the cackles, if you will, of my moderate, conservative, libertarian feminism. And another issue is that you don't see many people within the black community who are willing to publicly chastise R. Kelly, you know, for this alleged crime and how that relates to his celebrity and to gender. There were a couple of guys who tried to protest here in Chicago, and they were basically shouted down by R. Kelly supporters who seem to revere his celebrity so much that they're not even willing to entertain the possibility that he may have done this crime.
I want to move on to one last topic. Last week in Philadelphia, a local Fox TV helicopter videotaped at least 12 mostly white officers beating three black men suspected in a shooting. That beating happened near an area where police officers were conducting a manhunt. They were looking for a suspect in a bank robbery. 2 days earlier, a Philadelphia police officer was shot to death. Now, Jay, some people are comparing this to, you know, Rodney King. That was back in 1991 in Los Angeles. Do you think it is?
I think it's similar. I mean, again, if you look at the dynamic, you know, the Philadelphia case, I think, and this is just my opinion, there seem to be a lot more, there's a lot more gray area here. I mean, the three gentlemen who were leaving the scene of a crime or may not have been leaving the scene of a crime, you know, it's up in the air as to whether this is a case of mistaken identity. There was allegedly a fourth individual who got out and ran away on foot who may have been tied to a prior police shooting. So, you know, there's so much going on here. But I think overall, yes, it's similar to Rodney King in terms of it being an undeniable case of police brutality. But I think we as a community have to get just as upset about the 392 people that were killed in the city of Philadelphia last year, 310 of which were black men. I mean, I don't know. It's easy to get upset and excited about these things when there's a video all over YouTube. But you know, is one life any more important than others? I don't think so.
Shay, I mean, how can you talk about this issue and still also frame the crisis of the murders in Philadelphia, the victims in Philadelphia, like Jay was talking about?
Well, I mean, I think we all agree that, you know, that justice should prevail. And in this case, the cops, you know, had their own kind of justice on these men and convicted these men from the jump. So definitely the beating was excessive, and there's no excuse for what we saw in that videotape. I think we can still say, hey, this was, you know, a very bad situation, while also saying, I don't see it as an either or. We can also say, you know, look at these 300 and something murders of, you know, black people, black crime victims as well, and also keep our focus on, you know, police brutality when it comes. I don't see it as an either or situation.
Meji, you're talking to us from San Antonio,
right,
Texas. Are people talking about this, I mean, all the way across the country in Philadelphia?
Well, actually, I think I saw it on the news once in San Antonio. It's not really that big around here, but on the internet, which I'm on, you know, every day, I read about it and I looked at the video, and I think, like, it was a case of, like, street justice, because the police officers lost an officer last week, you know, and they thought it was one of these guys that did it, and it seemed like a premeditated attack, as if they knew what they were going to do before they even got to the car and pulled them out, and they were just, you know, kicking them, like, violently. It looked like almost a gang jumping, but it was police officers. So, I mean, they thought they were above the law, and it was them dealing their own justice.
Jay, we have been talking this month about criminal justice. We're doing a month-long series on criminal justice, and one of the things that keeps coming up is the rift sometimes between communities and police officers.
Right.
And of the irony, of course, that some of the people who probably need the most protection
either
fear the police or feel intimidated that if they talk, they're going to be in trouble with their neighbors. How can we go about healing that divide?
I think, you know, we can't just put the onus on the police. I mean, they are there to protect and serve, and there are unfortunately bad apples in every bunch, and that's what keeps ending up on YouTube. But I think, honestly, that the community has to be more accepting and more open to working with police and just cooperating in general. You know, the tension between police and you know, the people in some communities, just they prohibit that from happening in the first place. So until that rift is cured in some way, shape, or form, you're going to keep seeing incidents like this, and you're going to keep seeing a dishonesty and distrust on both sides.
Shay, just quickly, Reverend Al Sharpton visited one of the men in jail. And do you think that Reverend Al Sharpton's involvement is a positive or negative? Will it raise attention, or how do you think that's going to play out?
Well, you know, I'm not usually Reverend Al Sharpton's biggest fan, but on this one, he and I are, you know, totally in agreement. You know, it will bring attention to the case in terms of how police officers basically convicted these men with, you know, without allowing the justice system of which they're a part to play itself out. So I think his involvement is a good thing. It'll raise attention to the issue. I just hope that he also raises attention about those, you know, more than 300 murders, you know, of black crime victims as well. I think
Do
both. I'd like to see him do both.
Shay, Jay, and Meji, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We spoke with Jay Anderson, who blogs at averagebro.com. He joined me at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Meji Alibi blogs at anythingblack.net. He spoke to us from KSTX in San Antonio, Texas. And Shay Riley writes for bookerrising.blogspot.com and joined us from WBEZ in Chicago. You're listening to News and Notes from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. And from Kay and Matthew Buxbaum, supporting the development of NPR's new programming and new media. From Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater Company's production of Hamlet, starting May 22nd at Carter Barron Amphitheater in Washington, D.C. And from the American Psychiatric Association, committed to helping people have healthy minds and lives. Learn about mental illnesses and treatments at healthyminds.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Singer Nina Simone died in 2004. Now her daughter Simone is creating her own distinctive voice. Simone says that for her debut CD, she had to sing her mother's songs.
Where I say, it's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. It exemplifies my life right now. And
I'm
feeling
good. I'm Farai Judea. Simone sings Simone. Next time on News and Notes from NPR News. Dragonfly out in the sun. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. For generations, Americans lived by the one-drop rule. That is, whoever had one drop of black blood was black. It was a very expedient rule when it came to slavery. It meant, among other things, that fathers could enslave their own children under the full measure of the law. Today, our understanding of race is evolving. Barack Obama's race for the White House also spurred a conversation about what it means to be biracial and how that affects our understanding of blackness. Writer Francie Latour took a look at her own assumptions about race and identity in a recent article for the Boston-based Lola magazine. She's the associate editor of Wellesley magazine and a former reporter for the Boston Globe. Hi, Francie.
Hi, Farai. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. So in the May issue of Lola, you write about your family. You're black. Your husband is white. You've got two young children. And before you had children, you told your husband that any kids you had together would be black, no matter how light or dark their skin was. So how did your husband react?
He was speechless. and angry. You know, my husband has a very strong sense of rootedness in his own Irish-American identity. And so, and I think it's just very difficult outside of the African-American context to understand the history and the impact and the sort of staying power of the one-drop rule that you described. And basically, he responded by saying, well, they're going to be half-white, too. And I just wasn't sure where to go from there because that seems like an impossibility to me, the notion of being half white, or it did until Barack Obama.
So you yourself are coming from a perspective where in some ways your idea of blackness is one that you shared with most African Americans, where, you know, we were just raised to think, well, black is black, no matter how light, no matter how dark, no matter how mixed, black is black. What prompted you to reevaluate this specifically, you know, in the Obama campaign and in the course of the presidential election?
Well, as I saw Barack Obama gain momentum over the past several months, I really started to feel more optimistic that something was changing in this country. And I guess the pivotal moment for me was the moment when he gave his race speech in Philadelphia. And I've always been very torn about this idea that people who are biracial or multiracial in this country can sort of self-identify, can just sort of choose from a menu of identities and have that be the end of the story. I think the experience of race in this country, no matter how diluted or concentrated, is very much an experience of the dominant society, white society, kind of telling you who you are. But when I saw him give his race speech and sort of talk about how he had sort of absorbed and how he contains all of these different identities in such an authentic and deeply abiding way. It really started to change my sense of the limitations of race in the American context.
Let's talk a little bit more about your family and your children. You live in a small town, and you say that you've been mistaken for your children's nanny since, for example, your three-year-old can look, and these are your words, Mayan, Polynesian, or Native American. So I'm just curious, what did you say to somebody who mistook you for your child's nanny?
I actually said I wasn't the nanny. Sometimes it gets asked explicitly, and other times it's asked more subtly. For example, people will come up to me and say, "He's so cute. Is he yours?" With a very
he said, "I just borrowed him."
Right. I'm gonna have to give him back. And so I don't know why, but it's only happened about a half a dozen times. But each time, I'm completely shocked because. It's always sort of in some kind of random context that I'm not entirely prepared for because I'm just out with my kids in the world, living my life, going to the post office or the dry cleaners. And I think, you know, a lot of it is the product of the fact that, you know, my children are quite, they're quite fair skinned. I mean, they're quite light. I don't think that anyone looking at them, my son is 3, my daughter is 6 months old, would look at them and say, that's a black baby or that's a black toddler. And I think that probably generates a lot of the confusion or assumptions. But it works both ways, too. My husband was just out with our 3-year-old, and a black woman who was a nanny for a white child thought that my son was the son of the Brazilian woman who was standing behind my husband. So I think the assumptions can work both ways, but I mean, I think that, again, goes to the staying power of people's assumptions about race. You know, to some people it seems improbable that I'm my children's mother, and to other people it seems improbable that my husband is their father.
And, you know, I think that, you know, in general it might be the kind of thing where you think, oh, maybe African Americans would be more enlightened or more accepting because we do have people of so many different shades within our community. But I was with a friend who is mixed race black, and someone walked up and complimented her on her child and noticed that her child was black. And my friend was like, and so's the mother, you know, so and this was a black woman who made the comment. So, I mean, you know, do you ever feel like within the black community that you also face these challenges of negotiating people's expectations?
As a parent or as, well, I mean,
as a parent or as a wife or both?
how can I answer that? I spend a lot of time at home, especially now that I have kids. So I'm mostly confronting these situations that involve, white people making assumptions about me and my children. You know, when we go into Boston, both with my kids and with my husband when he was, you know, my boyfriend or my fiance or whatever, and we were living in the city, yes, I think, you know, we certainly got our fair share of double takes and then some, and not very subtle either by blacks. Which I also find just as disconcerting, if not more so.
You mentioned towards the end of your article that you are hopeful but not necessarily convinced that everything is moving in the right direction racially. Why do you think that?
Well, I really just don't know. You know, I am very hopeful because I think that, you know, my biggest fear as a parent is that my kids will somehow feel squeezed between these two identities and feel forced to choose one. And there are many stories of, you know, friends and acquaintances of mine who are biracial who go through these stages of, you know, rejecting their black parent or feeling embarrassed by their black parent. And then, you know, reading Malcolm X freshman year in college and then rejecting their white parent. I mean, it's a very common thing, or it's not uncommon at least. And I think Barack Obama, his, not just his candidacy, his existence, really, shows us a way out of that and beyond that. And that makes me feel extremely optimistic. But I, again, you know, all you have to do is look at some of the headlines lately between Obama and Clinton to know that race is still a very powerful kind of toxic thing.
Well, Francie, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Francie Latour is an associate editor at Wellesley Magazine and a former reporter for the Boston Globe. She wrote about racial identity for Lola Magazine.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Regina Bell is a singer and songwriter whose music is known for taking us to another place.
Unbelievable sights, indescribable feeling, soaring, tumbling, freewheeling, through an endless diamond sky, a whole new.
Of course, that was A Whole New World, her Grammy-winning song from the 1992 movie Aladdin with balladeer Peebo Bryson. Regina Bell's soulful sound has won her many such accolades for hits like Make It Like It Was and Baby Come to Me. A versatile artist, she's recorded many genres, but never gospel, until now. Her first gospel album, titled Love Forever Shines, hits stores this week, and Regina Bell joins us now. Welcome. Congratulations on the new project.
Thank you.
Why was it time to do a gospel album?
Well, it's something I've always wanted to do. It's always been something dear to my heart. The timing just wasn't right, be it that, you know, the record company didn't think it was appropriate or didn't want to put the money out or, you know, I was on tour or whatever. And then this opportunity came and I knew it was, you know, God answering a call because of the fact that two record companies came together to put this record out. Sunday, it'll be 21 years that I will be celebrating in the industry. And in my 21 years of performance, I have never, ever heard of two record companies coming together to do one project. Usually, record companies are kind of competing against one another. So I kind of knew that it was time because too many things were falling in place too easily.
Well, let's just play a little bit and then we'll talk about it. Let's play Can't Nobody. Oh, see, now you're going to make us have church up in here, okay? See, why are you going to get that going? So. Oh, my goodness. So this music is speaking to you in a way that, is it speaking to you in a way that it did not before, or is it something that you are returning to?
It's never left me. I mean, gospel music and just the word of God has always been something that's been with me. Church is not something that you can contain in four walls. The church has to be in you. You are the church. So that message has kind of gone with me everywhere I've gone.
You grew up
but
singing in church, right?
Absolutely. But the thing is that as you get older, you develop, a more mature relationship. And that's what this record is about, that, you know, I was able to not only sing some gospel, but I was able to share some of my personal experiences through the music and possibly help somebody in their journey trying to make it, just trying to get through life.
Did you ever feel torn between singing secular and singing sacred music, like so many
Absolutely.
Artists who grow up in the church?
Absolutely. It is something that as you go through your life being in church. I'm a church baby. I grew up in the church. So there were things that while I was on tour and I was coming back home to, you know, be in church and visit with my family and stuff like that, there were individuals, even part of my family, you know, that would say, you know, well, when you going to, you know, come back to the roots? When you going to come back to what you're supposed to be singing? And that's a difficult pressure to live with, especially when you come back to church and they're asking you to sing. And then, you know, the church lights up after you sing. And, you know, it's a difficult, and it's more difficult, not necessarily just what people say, but I think the difficulty comes in more so within that war that you're fighting inside yourself. But, you know, I believe, you know, as I began to study the word a little bit more, and I came across a passage in the scriptures that said all things work together for the good of them that love the Lord. So all of us can't take the same journey. There are some places that I have to go that maybe some church folks aren't willing to go. No, when I go back in the club, I'm going to talk about it. So, okay. You know what I'm saying? So I'm going in and I'm coming out the same way I went in. So wherever I'm led to just talk about him and declare him, that's what I'm going to do.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News, and we're speaking with Grammy Award-winning soul singer Regina Bell about her first gospel album, Love Forever Shines. One of the things about this album is it's all gospel, but it really mm-hmm. travels the genres of music. I want to play, I think it's the first single that's been released from the album, God is Good. I think your brother wrote it?
Yeah.
Is that
brother,
right? All right.
My brother Bernard Bell.
God, my God. God is good. Said he saved my soul. God is good. I said that he saved.
We're going back to the roots right here. Going back to the roots right here. But then we're going to go the other direction. And you tie into another genre with God Said.
Tell me who can compare and can stand beside. Match his love and his grace and his sacrifice. Gives us love that lives on to eternity.
Almost like you're having a family argument in this album. Is you like your dad arguing with your brothers, arguing with you about what's the true gospel? It's interesting because some artists like Kirk Franklin give us maybe what we could call edgy gospel. Some critics are quick to say they aren't being true to the genre. In fact, the mm-hmm. introduction to God is Good alludes to that, saying, you know, some feel that, you know, the music has strayed. So what's your take on that? Are you kind of staking a place in this argument with these two songs?
No, my thing is the message. I want to make sure the message is clear. I want it to be clear what it is I'm saying and exactly who it is I'm talking about. I think it takes all of us to, you know, win souls over. I don't think that we have the opportunity to say who's valid and who's not. I see Kirk Franklin's music as being very valid, very much needed. But then again, I also see Helen Baylor being very needed, you know, so there are places that all of us are able to minister that some of the other artists aren't able to. So I think it takes all of us.
Some of the songs feel very personal to mm-hmm. to me. Are they?
Absolutely. I can't do music without it being personal. You know, even if I didn't write it, I have to have some sort of experience in knowing what it's about. I don't necessarily have to have gone through everything that I sing about. God, please don't let me go through everything that I sing about.
But you mentioned that in some of the materials that come with the album, that you had gone through some things prior
Absolutely.
To producing this work, that you were very candid about the fact that you have had in the past a struggle with alcohol.
Well, it wasn't necessarily the struggle with alcohol as much as it was the struggle with my own self. I wasn't an alcoholic. You know, I drank only socially. I only drank with my friends. I never drank at home, and I never drank when I had problems. It was this one particular night I had an issue, and it was a situation where I was dating a young man, and, you know, we were having this argument. And so my thing was is that he needed to come and apologize. okay, which is really stupid. Let me preface by saying this first. I gave it X number of time for him to come and apologize. And if he wasn't coming, I was going to drink this whole fifth of Hennessy.
I'm so hoping you didn't drink
it. Oh, but I did it. After I drank it, I was sitting there and I didn't even feel buzzed, high, nothing. And I was like, okay, maybe I just, let me stand up. Okay. So I stand up and I absolutely have no, it has no effect on me. And right then and there, I got scared to death. And I said, you have my attention, Lord. What are you trying to tell me? And it was very clear to me that if I didn't stop being so arrogant and so thinking that I got all of this under control and that, you know, I don't really need anybody, that I can do everything by myself and I can control other people. If I didn't get away from that sort of attitude, that I was going to pay dearly. And so I stayed up most of the night just having a talk with the Lord. That was back in 1989.
Wow.
And that was the last drink I had.
So do you feel that...
you feel like you're talking to the crazy person.
No, right? Not a bit. No, not a bit. Because
no, going to tell the truth.
That's what I'm saying. Because you say in the liner notes, I'm so excited about this. I tried to be as transparent as I could so that this project might help somebody.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because I, you know, people look at me and think that I have it all together. And, you know, a lot of times we put, you know, athletes and entertainers and actors on a pedestal. And, you know, if you see anything good in me, I want you to know it's not by my own doing. That, you know, it's been God's covering, his keeping, and his provision. And through it all, you know, I've had some times where I thought I was going to go crazy. I've had some times when I felt like I was really, really all alone. And, it, you know, the Grammy couldn't wipe the tears from my eyes at night. The Grammy couldn't put its arms around me and tell me, you know, you're going to get through this. When you come to those kind of crossroads in your life, stuff and things and fans, it doesn't help you. When you feel that kind of a void in your life, that's more spiritual. And a physical thing can't do nothing for you. So at that point, if you're not made of something other than, you know, your lifestyle or your celebrity, you headed for a really bad way.
You're the proud mom of five. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing you probably are very much in touch with the music that they're listening to.
Well, the great thing about my kids is that they don't listen to just anything because, you know, they're coming out of my household. So, you know, my son, 16, his favorite artist of all time is Sade. You know, he listens to Lou Rawls. I mean, 16 years old. You know, my 18-year-old listens to Melba Moore, Faith Evans. They like the contemporary. They like the Chris Brown and, you know, Neo and all of the Kanye West. They like Beyonce, all of the ones that are pretty much at the top of their game now. But they also have a very interesting love and devotion, I would even call it, to the classics.
I do wonder if sometimes you listen to some of the younger artists and you think to yourself, they don't even know. Do you ever listen to some of these younger artists and think, gosh, I wish I could let you know what was ahead. I wish I could save you some time on that trip.
Well, it takes some of those trips that you're talking about to make the person what they need to be, because the deal is that you can't know about life unless you live life. And some of us have to take harder falls than others. I think what you're talking about, though, it is tragic in that we don't have a better touch with the new jacks and the veterans. We've been here a while. You know, I've been able to see some things. I've been able to do some things. So there's some pitfalls that, you know, I'm not necessarily, I know how to shy, stay away from. But because we don't have a closer contact, you know, when I was coming in to this industry, I had Nancy Wilson and Chaka Khan. I had a number of people, Patti LaBelle even, you know, pull me to the side and kind of just hit me to some things. They opened up about some things and kept me straight. Whereas now I don't see that kind of relationship with veterans and the new jacks that are coming into the industry. So, yeah, I do kind of feel like, well, as the song I sang, if I could, you know, there's so many things that I would shelter them from that they wouldn't have to go through. But, you know, it is what it is.
I'm dying to know how you balance it all. You are mom of five, pastor's wife, minister of music at your church in Atlanta, where your husband is the senior pastor, and you still maintain a very vibrant career. I think a lot of the moms out there are wanting to know, how do you keep it all going?
It's difficult, but, you know, my life has to be very structured. The thing is, when you get to this part of the game, you got to make your priorities known. You know, everybody has to work and do what they're supposed to do on their end. It means that everybody has to play their role and do their part and make sure that, you know, by the time I come to you now, it's not a big waste of time. We gotta know what we're supposed to be doing because I am on a schedule.
All right. Setting those boundaries. Well, speaking of working out, this congratulations on the new album. Do you have a favorite cut?
Probably the last song on the record is my favorite of all favorites because it was a song that I wrote. I was coming out of something and I was able to kind of put it to paper. And my prayer is that it'll bless somebody else.
All right. Can I tell you what my favorite?
What's your favorite?
Almost Slipped.
Really?
Yes. Almost Slipped.
Almost Slipped.
Uh-huh.
I took my eyes off of God.
Yes, I did.
I almost lost my way. The enemy had me low.
But I decided that I draw nearer to the Lord. You know, that's funny because if you get a chance, go home and read Psalms 73 because that's where that song comes out of.
Okay.
And what it was a praise and worship leader by the name of Asaph. He was looking around and saw people who never even cared anything about God, didn't desire to worship, didn't desire to praise, nothing. And it seemed like they were prospering before his eyes. And he knew that he was having struggles. You know, just how we struggle with our flesh from day to day, how we want to, like, tell some folks some things and we ain't supposed to do that. You know, that
kind of
thing.
Oh, now you tell me.
And so, he was looking at that struggle and then when he came into the sanctuary, God made him understand that all those things that they worship, you know, the stuff and the things and the lifestyle and the this and the that, you know, when they leave here, that's their legacy. Nothing. They absolutely lived for nothing. They didn't help nobody. They didn't try to live a better life for anybody. Any of those things that are important to not just your own life, but to other people's lives. So it wasn't, he explains that for him, he has to draw nearer to the Lord. He has to stay close to the Lord so he won't stray off and do some stupid stuff. So that's basically what the song is about.
Okay.
But that's great. Wow.
Okay.
That's my first testimony that it's helping somebody.
Okay.
So thank you.
All right.
To steal your joy, maybe through money, relationships, and so much more.
Well, we're going to go out on your favorite, which is I'll Never Leave You Alone. Grammy Award-winning artist Regina Bell, her debut gospel release, Love Forever Shines, is due in stores this week. You can find out more information about Regina Bell at our website, npr.org/tellmemore. She joined us from our studios at NPR West. Regina Bell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All you gotta do is hold on to me.